Exciting and RI seminar. Today it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Professor Donald Zeman. Professor Zeman graduated with a BA in literature, believe it or not, from Illinois University in 65. He switched a little bit the topic. He became interested in mathematics and he graduated in 1970 with a PhD in applied mathematics from University of Northwestern. Then he became distinguished professor until 2001 in University of Massachusetts. And then in 2001, he joined the Johns Hopkins University, where currently he's one of the members of the Center for Imaging Science and the Institute of Computational Medicine. He works in the intersection of computer science and applied mathematics, and he's specialized, his main interest in this test is in statistical learning theory, computer vision, and computational biology. And I'm pretty sure many of you have read the very famous paper about stochastic relaxation, Gibbs sampling, and Bayesian restoration of images. This is one of the 150 most cited papers in computer science, and Donald Zeman is one of the co-authors of this paper. This paper has more than 7,000 citations, so it's quite a bit. But today he's going to talk about how to build good features, among other things, to detect cuts in images. So I'll let you start.
Thank you, Fernando. Thanks for inviting me. I've actually never been to Carnegie Mellon except I believe one day in 1980 when I came here for some other reason having nothing to do with science. So finally come to sort of the Paris of, I'll call it the Paris, not another, got to be careful these days, the Paris of computer vision and robotics. So it's really a pleasure to be here and talk about this subject. And it does make connections with some people here, as you'll see in a minute. So here's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about sort of part two of a 10-year-old story. I work slowly. So part one was like 95 to 99, and it was joint work with François Fleuret at INRIA in France, outside Paris. And the problem was face detection. And lots of people were looking at face detection, not recognition, detection, just find and localize frontal views of human faces in still images. Not recognize who the person is, just say, where are the faces? And Takeo knows he was doing that too, and we were inspired by a paper of yours with Scheinerman was the name? And particularly one thing that you may not have thought of as the key feature, but for us the key feature was this little coarse-defined thing you did where you did it at two resolutions in some sense. Many people were working on face detection at that time. Our approach, the approach we took, was a little bit different. It was based on a coarse-defined search process. So here, I want to explain this because this is the backdrop for what I'm going to talk about today. So I'm going to tell you roughly, just in words mainly, what we did in the 90s and what was wrong with it and why we needed to revisit it and repair it or make it more efficient. So let me first tell you what the basic idea was. The idea was to build a recursive partitioning of the pose space and to build a binary classifier for every cell in this hierarchy. The job of that binary classifier is to say yes if there's a face in the image whose pose is in this cell, this is a subset of poses, and no otherwise. Moreover, this classifier has the added burden that it must say yes if there's a face with pose in this cell at the expense of having lots of false positives. You can't obviously impose both high detection rate and low false positive rate. And so our philosophy was to build classifiers that had a very, very small false negative error relative to the hypothesis being that a face was present. at the expense of false positive error. So just imagine for a minute that all faces that you were ever interested in, well, let me back up. What is the pose of a face? So by definition, the pose of a face will be the point between the eyes, so that's two parameters, the distance between the eyes and pixels, and the tilt. Okay? So it's this four-dimensional representation. That's what I mean by the pose. Imagine for just a moment that the only faces I ever had to consider were faces whose position was in some fixed 16 by 16 block, whose scale, again, the distance between the eyes, was between 8 and 16 pixels, and whose tilt was, let's say, minus 30 to 30. Just imagine that was the whole pose space. If I could handle that problem efficiently, I can partition the whole image into disjoint 16 by 16 blocks, visit each one, and run the classifier, and I could handle the faces that had scale 16 to 32 just by downsampling and rerunning the algorithm design for scale between 8 and 16. So let's just pretend for a minute this represents a reference range of poses. Again, let me repeat, scale 8 to 16, position in a fixed 16 by 16, and some range of tilts. Now, of course, the actual face will occupy a region around that 16 by 16 that's much larger. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do this classifier. This is my most general classifier. It's obviously going to have the highest false positive rate because it's attacking a harder problem than, say, this classifier. This classifier has to say yes if there's a face independently of its position in the block, independently of the scale, independently of the orientation. Suppose the first partition was 4 8x8 sub-blocks of this 16 by 16 block. Now, obviously, I don't really have to build four different classifiers. I just have to build one and shift it over, but let's put that aside. So I build four classifiers, one for each of these, et cetera. Now, maybe the next split was on scale, big scale, little scale, i.e. 12 to 16 versus 8 to 12. Maybe the split after that was on tilt, left tilt, right tilt. Maybe the split after that returned to scale and further divided the scale into, you know, the left half and the right half of the small scale range. You see what I mean? There might be another, et cetera. So we built a hierarchy manually with about six levels. And so finally, these fine cells would localize the position within something like a 2x2 or a 4x4, localize the scale within a few pixels. You get the idea. And the strategy was, do this class, it's breadth first course defined search. Do this classifier. If the answer is no, leave that whole cell, leave the whole 16 by 16, because you know there's no face because of the false negative constraint. If the answer is yes to this classifier, do each of these four children. Anytime you get a no answer, you can remove the entire sub-hierarchy because of the zero false negative constraint. And when you're all done, just collect the fine level cells where you did the classifier and it was positive. Necessarily, all the parents were positive up to the root, and declare those to be your detections by definition at that resolution of poses. Okay? That's the idea. Okay, so what's good about it? Well, it's very fast online, very, very fast. It was basically real time. Not quite. We were processing, I don't know, 10 frames a second. And then, you know, Viola Jones came along in 2000 and had real time classification. But it was, compared to other classifiers that were about in the 90s, it was extremely fast. Focusing is, you know, in a natural way, due to the course-defined search, you tend to focus on the hard examples. For example, what do I mean? If you look at a density of work image on a scene, you would see that you spend almost no time in a flat part of the scene. Because in a flat part of the scene, you exit that hierarchy very rapidly. Whereas in clutter and near face-like structures, you tend to go much deeper, and hopefully you go all the way to the end if there's really a face. But if there are things that have a lot of texture in the middle of a forest or something like that, you might penetrate well into the hierarchy before exiting. Whereas if you're just in a flat area, you would probably exit, as a rule, with the very first classifier would say no. Do you see what I mean? So it was, there's a natural focusing on hard examples. Now, all of this is, you know, to the extent to which you're nodding your head and all that, that's because of the Viola-Jones cascade thing. But this wasn't obvious to us when we started this in 96, 97, and finished this work around 99. Okay. So what were the disadvantages? Oh, and by the way, what was the performance? So the performance, I like to summarize the performance in face detection as follows. I think the take-home message is, if you run face detectors on large image databases, and you set your algorithm for a 90% detection rate, that is to say, you're going to detect 9 out of 10 of the faces. Let's put aside the resolution at which you detect the pose. Let's just, we have some way of saying you got the face or you didn't. Then you're going to make about one false positive per 480 by 640 image. That, at least 5 years ago, was the state of the art. One hallucination per 480 by 640 if you're going to get 90% of the faces. Okay, it's dropped. So maybe it's a half. But you know, it's not a tenth. It's that order. It's order one. It's no longer order 10, as it was at some point. It's not down to order, you know, one-tenth. I think it's still order one. And that's the kind of rough performance we had. Now, it's true you had to build the hierarchy manually. That was a deficit. And I had a graduate student in the first part of this decade who worked on automatic construction of the hierarchy. Another problem, it wasn't exactly a problem, but another inefficiency was when you're all done, there's information in the tests you did in what I call the trace processing, the history of processing. Which classifiers I identify, where did they stop, and so forth. There's information that's being thrown out simply by taking just the full chains. And so we put a probability distribution on the history of processing. I called it the trace model. But there were two more severe liabilities, and those are the two I want to talk to you today, about today. There are a lot of classifiers to learn. Now, I know we can synthesize face data. I mean, we know that this has the same name if I move it over and if I scale it, right? So using, by exploiting transformations that we know preserve the names of things, we can synthesize data, obviously, to a specific pose cell. Literally, if you don't think of it that way, when I go to build that classifier, my training, what training examples do I have? Well, without synthesizing data, without using knowledge of the world, the training samples I have are exactly those faces in my training set whose pose is in that cell, right? If I don't do anything else. And so obviously there's a massive data fragmentation problem. No matter how many training samples I have up top here, by the time I get down to fine cells, I might have very few data. Even exploiting like crazy transformation, you know, transforming the images to artificially make data for different pose cells, you still have a problem. And so those were the two, and they're linked. Those were the two main disadvantages. Many classifiers to learn, one per cell, hence growing exponentially in the depth of this representation of the hypothesis space, and data fragmentation. So we had no idea how to solve either of them between 2000 and 2006 or 5. I just put it to rest. And then we had some new ideas, we being Francois Fleury and myself. And what I want to talk to you about today is how we've tried to overcome those problems, not for faces, I'm not going to talk anymore about faces, but for cats. Why cats? Okay. I'm going to skip this, by the way, even though this is a computer vision group, it's not important for this talk. You'll have to take my word for it. Why cats? Well, I was giving a talk about 7 years ago, and David Mumford was there, and he said to me, I was showing the work on face detection with coarse-defined hierarchies, coarse-defined decomposition of the pose space, and he said, Don, what about cats? You know, there's a really high-dimensional pose space. It's not just a position, a scale. I mean, it's, if you want to characterize a cat, it's really high dimensional. How is this thing ever going to extend to a complex representation, a really complex representation, deformable objects? Well, I absorbed that comment. I didn't do anything about it. I can't say that I thought about it that frequently, but it lodged in my mind. So when I came back to the subject with Francois a few years ago, we decided, let's try something harder. Now, I used to criticize the computer vision community. I used to always joke that when I came into computer vision, I was very struck by the fact that the modus operandi of this community seemed to be, if you can't solve a problem, try a harder one. And to some extent, that's true. But so here I, OK, we did not solve the face detection problem. You know, we had false positives.
Because the goal requirement is lower.
The what?
Goal requirement is lower.
Exactly. You got it. The goal requirement, the bar goes down, right? Particularly if you're there first, right? So we thought, OK, you know, this is really going to pose a challenge because the complexity of description of a cat is like unbounded. I mean, depending on how what you mean. We want to do more than detect. We want to detect and describe. I'm not interested in, you know, the problem of given a scene, is there a cat in the scene, yes or no? I want to know where the cat is, where the, you know, hopefully where are the ears, where's the head, where's the body, make me a little cartoon with an ellipse for the body and a circle for the head, where are the ears, is the tail visible, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm not going to do all that today, but that's the problem you'd really like to solve. That's the problem we solve. We do that. You know, we can give, I can give you a little, when I see a scene with a cat, I can give you a little story about it, about, you know, where different parts of the cat are. So let's forget the hierarchy now. I'm going to come back to this in about a half an hour. Forget the hierarchy for now, okay? Just take one level. So one level of the hierarchy is what? It's a partition of the pose space, okay? So let's Y be a space of poses. And let Y1 through YK be a partition of the pose space. And let I be an image. And let boldface Y, 1 to K, be the interpretation of the image. So Y sub K, oops, wrong button, but it doesn't matter. Y sub K is a Boolean variable, 1 or 0. It says 1 if there's an object in the image with pose in this cell, 0 otherwise. So my interpretation of the scene are these K bits, each one telling me yes or no there's an object with pose in cell K. Okay? And I'm thinking of one generic category of objects, chairs, cats, faces, something like that. Okay? So that's my scene description. So in this scene, there are two, I'm going to make, I know this is kind of the world book, we used to call it the world book version, you know, as opposed to the Britannica version, you know, just kindergarten stuff, particularly for CMU and robotics and computer vision. But I want to make sure everybody understands what I mean by this partition and what I means by a scene description. OK, there's two faces. Here are the positions. Let's suppose that my partition of the pose space is only based on position. Doesn't take into account scale or any other parameters that might appear in the description of the pose. OK, I have 48 cells in my partition. The ideal answer would be all of these are 0, these two are 0, this one is a 1, this is 0, 0, et cetera, et cetera. It's obvious, right? That's the ideal answer. Okay, that would be the correct description of the scene. OK, now for faces, in most of the work on faces, typically the space was low dimensional, reasonably low dimensional. It was position, scale, and orientation of the face. You can equivalently define the face by the positions of the two eyes. It's the same thing as I described earlier. And oops. Well, cats, and by the way, I'll show you many cats later, but let me just tell you where we got our data from, because it's a fun story. We have 112,000 pictures of cats. So when we started working this, we thought, you know, where are we going to get a database of cats? And Francois said, you know, I saw this website called Rate My Kitten. He said, we can't lose. We can ask, you know. Maybe they have a lot of cats, you know. People are crazy about their cats, right? So Francois calls the guy, calls this number, gets somebody on the phone, and says, this may seem crazy, but could we have your database? And the guy says, okay. So the only thing he wanted was to acknowledge the website and Rate My Kitten, which I'll do at the end. And that's it. And he sends Francois 112,000 pictures of cats. So at this point, we've only used 2,000 of them. We have 110,000 held out. I don't know what we're going to do with those. We'll see. So what's the pose of a cat? Well, it's obviously, I mean, without going into details, it's obviously a more complex thing than the pose of a face, right? I don't know what's the right number of parameters to describe it, but it's pretty complex. I mean, you know, there are harder problems. I guess, you know, you could try to detect blankets or something, but it's pretty tough. Well, a coarse description, still coarse, I would maintain, is just center of the head. The head is roughly, you can assume the head is a circle. It's not a bad assumption. It's anatomy, you know. So the center of the head, the scale of the head, and roughly some point that roughly captures the center of the body. Now, we've since looked at more. I just want to keep it at that. Just go up a little bit from a face and see how we might detect cats, this being our representation. OK, so there's a very strange symbol there. Oh, well, I don't know. Do you see it? I mean,
yes.
I don't know where that came from.
Cursor?
Oh, it's a cursor. OK, well, it's not serious. That means I could move it? No, I don't know. Never mind. I don't know anything about it. I'm a complete idiot about it. I mean, my graduate students laugh at me all the time. I discover functions on the computer that, you know, they thought everybody knew, like a key that allows you to recover what you type, you know, and not have to type it again. And OK, I'm not going to say anymore. So we have a database of images. And we have, they're labeled by, again, this k-dimensional binary vector, which is their annotation. OK? And I have T, capital T of these, something's weird here, capital T of these, oh, I know, it's just a comma. And I'm interested in building a detector, FK, one for every pose cell, which, you know, given an image, will say yes or no for that pose cell. I mean, on the face of it, that's my job. And for predicting why. So if I didn't know anything about the world, if I couldn't synthesize images, if I couldn't move cats around in a way to, you know, make them satisfy a certain pose condition, technically, the data I would have to train classifier FK would be this. This would be my training set over T, right? I would just look in the teeth image, you know, is there a cat, you know, yes or no, there's a cat in pose cell K. And the ones for which this was 1 would be my positive examples. The ones for which this is 0 are my negative examples. I could augment the negative examples. It's, of course, the positive ones we're concerned about. So if I didn't use knowledge of the world and whole image transformations, that would be my data set.
But so there are some transformation rotation scale that you can synthesize, but there are others that you cannot.
Right. Exactly.
Out.
That's my whole point. That's why I'm going to claim, that's why I want to argue that you cannot get out of the data fragmentation dilemma by synthesis. Not just because transformations may not exist, that's on the next slide, but because if you think about it carefully, you have to do those transformations offline to train, that's OK, and online at the time of detection. So there are a lot of problems with whole image transformations, particularly when you're doing complex ones, highly nonlinear ones, online. So whole image transformations, I want to argue, is not the solution to the data fragmentation problem. OK, so of course, each FK is trained with a fragment of the data. Now, to avoid fragmentation, people usually normalize, right? If you think about what you do when you normalize, this is just You know, maybe you might be saying to yourself, only a mathematician could write it this way, but what you're doing is you're bringing them, you're doing whole image transform for each pose or pose cell. I think of pose or pose cell. It's, you are transforming the image, right, to another image, and you're kind of lining them up in some sense so that you can use all of your images to train any given pose cell. That's what you're doing. Now, just if you thought about it mathematically and you said that that's what you're doing, you're lining them up, if you thought about it and you said, this is going to be my new training set now to make this one classifier that I'm going to make from my normalized data, the condition you would want would this would be IID, independent identically distributed. That's what you want of any training set, right? You want it to be independent identically distributed. So this mysterious point here, if you think it through, would be the very condition you would need to preserve identical distribution after transformation, to preserve the ID part of IID. No, independent ID. To preserve the ID after the I, you would need that. So what would you do, and what do people do when they do normalization, when they transfer all the faces over to have a fixed position if they're just building a, you know, building a detector that's going to, if the only parameter of the face were translation, you would just translate all the data. You collect all your data together via these transformations, and you build one classifier G from this aggregated training set, and then you apply this transformation to a new image, and that's your classifier for post cell K. Okay, that's a formal way, but that describes what everybody's doing. So samples are aggregated for training. Well, you got to do that online and offline, all those whole image transfers. They have to exist, those transformations, and you have to perform them online. And so this is not a particularly good example to illustrate why it doesn't exist, but it's not very hard. It wouldn't take you very long to convince yourself that you're going to have trouble defining these transformations when you go to a really complex pose space, when you get out of the translation rotation world. Okay. So what people are doing is they're doing whole image transforms with these functions phi. They have a base, did I define C? I'm sorry, did I miss that? Base set of features? Huh. Oh yeah. C is my base set of features, whatever your feature set is. Most of my talk is going to be independent of the particular feature you use, particular classifiers you use, particular learning algorithm. C is your base set of features, what you extract from the image. It's a vector. So instead of going along this route, let's imagine this route. Let's imagine directly indexing the features by the pose. Okay, so let me be careful about it. Let me define carefully what I mean and show you some examples at the risk. I'm going to take the risk of belaboring the point because I want everybody to understand what I mean by a stationary feature. So first, just formally, it's a mapping from pose cross image to RM. So for every pose or pose cell and every image, it's an n-dimensional vector. It has this property. If I condition on the event that there is a cat whose pose is in cell K, the probability distribution of the feature vector corresponding to cell K does not depend on K. This, there's just one generic distribution for this, phi of x or something. Does not depend on K. Okay, I'm going to drill that point in. I want to help you understand that point with some pictures and with an example.
So is K the location of the image, for example?
K could be the location of the image, or K more generally could be a collection of locations, scales, and translations.
I understand, but wouldn't
teacher outcome depend on location, for example, within the class? Like you'd see some.
Not, no. It, well, let's. Remember, x is indexed by k, so I'm free to choose that vector any way I want.
Okay, you can put k inside x, is what you're saying.
So, to make this a little clearer, let's imagine there was only one cat in the image. I'm restricting myself to the world of having only one cat. I can then define a new random variable y, I called it z, excuse me, which is the pose cell occupied by that cat. It's unique because it's a partition of the pose space. So it's well defined. Okay? What I'm saying is that those two random variables are independent. If I report to you the outcome of the feature vector, you don't know anything about the pose. If I say, here's what I found. I found 32.7, 6.21, blah, blah, blah. You don't know anything about the pose. They're independent random variables. When I evaluate the pose index feature at the random pose, it is independent of the pose itself. And if you think through it, that's exactly what you want to aggregate data. And this will come out in a minute. So in other words, knowing the outcome of the feature vector does not help you guess the pose. Now, of course, we want that generic distribution to be very different than when there's background. But it will not help you guess the pose. Here's an example. Let's suppose that the pose is the position of this screw in the two tips. And what I'm doing is I'm putting down a circle here, and I'm looking at edges in this direction. You know, something like the frequency of edges among all edges in this window, what's the fraction that are southwest to northeast? And I, relative to the same parameterization, I put the window here, and here it's over here. Now, here it's edges in this direction. Well, it's here it's going to be edges maybe more in this direction. Here it's going to be edges in this direction. I'm free to define it that way because this is indexed by the pose, the feature vector. What I'm saying is, with the appropriate definition of the orientation of the edges, the statistics collected from these three windows are identical. Let me give you a more concrete example. My signal is the simplest signal you can have. It's Gaussian noise that goes along at this base level 0. At some point, theta 1, it pops up to 1. Then it goes back down at theta 2 to 0 and hangs at 0. So there's the probability distribution of the data. Given the pose, theta 1, theta 2, it's a product of normals up to theta 1, a product of normals with mean 1 between theta 1 and theta 2, and then back to a product of normals after theta 2. Okay, can't have a simpler signal than that. So what would be a pose index feature? Well, I'm going to collect the value before the jump, at the jump, at the end, and then after that. I get four numbers. It's a four-dimensional vector. The distribution of that vector is independent of theta 1, theta 2. There it is. There's the distribution of that vector conditioned on the pose. You don't see any theta 1, theta 2 in here. It's stationary.
But are you going to learn these features?
Yes. To make? Well, that's another subject. We're going to define them, and we're going to show what happens with cats and that it works in practice. Learning them, I'll come back to later, learning them automatically. But so far, they're well defined. It's well defined what you want, you know, the goal. So now, look what happens. What you do then is you aggregate all your data together, here it is, and you build one classifier. One classifier from all the aggregated data. You know that this is IID because of the stationarity condition. I'm sweeping a few things under the rug. The pose cells have to have about equal probability. But if you go through the mathematics, you'll see that this is a legitimate training set. It makes sense to train on it. So you build one classifier And then you transform it to all the others. You make all the ones at a level of the hierarchy from that one analytically. And I've used all the data for training. So if it works, I've satisfied both my problems. I've only built one classifier per level of the hierarchy, and I've generated all the others analytically, and I've used all my data to build every classifier. That's the basic idea. I said this already. Okay? So now, in the next part of the talk, the next 10 minutes or so, I want to show you how this plays out for cats. So the features we use are edge features, just indexed by a position in the image, and I can't even read it, an angle and a scale. So OK, the angle is the usual thing. You know, there's actually, we have 8 types of edges corresponding to 4 orientations, 2 polarities, light to dark and dark to light. And we do it at 3 different scales. That's not the way. It doesn't matter how you do it. I mean, there's a zillion ways to do it. We don't actually downsample the image and compute them again. We do it at the resolution of the original image, but relative to 2x2 blocks and then 4x4 blocks. I mean, that's not that important. So, and we use these nonparametric edge detectors that we've been using for 10 years now in our lab. So if you want to, it's a binary random variable that says 1 if the pixel intensity difference between these two is bigger than these other 6, and 0 otherwise. That's our edge detector. That's invariant to linear transformations of the grayscale. We like it because it has that invariance property. So if you make a linear transformation of the image, we get exactly the same edges by definition. So that's the basic edge detector, and there's a cat, and these are the edges, the 8 types found at scale 1, scale 2, scale 3. So that's our most basic feature, are these edge features. We use 3 types. Now, this is a terrible mistake. What an awful typo. That should be base features. We use 3 types of base features. One is, I mentioned it a while, for any particular orientation and scale and any window W, it's the proportion of edges of that type at that scale among the ones of that scale in W. We find these to be very powerful features. That should come as no news. It seems to be in the air all over the computer vision world that the fraction of edges of a particular type in a window is a very powerful feature. And for us, it's really it just works beautifully. We also have 2 other kinds of base features. The L1 distance between histograms of orientations in 2 windows, and just the L1 distance between the histograms of the gray levels in 2 windows. So those are the 3 kinds of base features. So the first type is indexed by a window, a phi, and a sigma. Sigma is 1, 2, or 3. Phi is 0 to 7. The second type is indexed by a pair of windows and an orientation and a scale. Oh, no, this is the histogram of orientations. So it's indexed by a pair of windows and a scale. And the third type is indexed by a pair of windows. Okay, that's our pool of features. OK, so now how do we build stationary features? I'm going to show you the vanilla version, the simplest. So the simplest version I could do to illustrate this would have a hierarchy with 2 levels. The top level would just correspond to translation, and the bottom level would bring in all the other parameters. So 2 windows. OK. OK, so here is a cat with its position over here. Here's a cat with its position over here. Imagine I'm at the highest level of the hierarchy, so I've just, remember that partition I had with y1, y2, y3, up to y48, based just on position. Well, it's obvious that the statistics of this feature, finding edges of this kind, should be approximately the same as the statistics of this feature over here. I just slide the window over. I also have to deform, scale it, but let's take scale out of the picture to make it even simpler. I'm trying to pare this down to the simplest thing that will make the next level non-trivial. and will make the concept of the stationary features non-trivial at the next level. So here, I'm just using the fact that translation preserves statistics. When it's an object like the head and I pin the center and the scale is fixed. Now I come to the next level. Let's suppose my first level of the hierarchy is just the head position. But now the next level of the hierarchy takes into account both the head position and the belly position. So what is a pose cell now? A pose cell is, you know, head in a certain region, head position in a certain region, and belly position in a certain region is a pose cell. What I'm claiming is relative to this coordinate system, this is very simple, this feature, which looks for edges and fraction of edges in this direction, should have about the same statistics as this feature does. This one is defined in this coordinate system the same way that this one is defined in this coordinate system. This is obvious. So that's how I build the stationary features. It's not exact because the angle made between this line and this line is not exactly one of my orientations, you know what I mean, of the edges and all that, but it's good enough. And we've actually done, I'm going to skip over this very quickly, but I have a student who's actually done some formal statistical hypothesis tests. If you go back to your statistics, remember, one of the things you learn is, given two samples, you can test whether they come from the same distribution or not. So one way to do it, if you want to do it against a general alternative that allows for all kinds of shape differences in the densities, you have basically two choices, a chi-square test in the discrete world and a Kolmogorov-Smirnov test in the continuous world. But you can do a formal statistical hypothesis test. And we've actually done that with features on cat ears. A formal statistical hypothesis test, you actually get p-values for the probability they come from the same distribution. So we took ears going this way, computed thousands and thousands of features, and for several hundred samples, got a p-value for every feature. And more complex ones. I'm showing you the baby versions. And this is an example. One of the particular features, these are the two cumulative distribution functions. It happens to have a p-value of 0.85. Little quiz for those who've ever taken statistics. If I have two distributions that are really the same, and I do this 44,000 times, and I collect 44,000 p-values, what should the distribution of the p-values be? What should I see if I really have stationarity when I make a histogram of the p-values from a Kolmogorov-Smirnov test of homogeneity? Uniform. Basic probability should be uniform, and it almost is. And the reason it's not exactly just comes from the fact that you sometimes have the same cat. So the two ears, it's too good. You know, it's like the famous Mendel's P experiment where the chi-square statistic is too small. It's almost smoking pistol evidence that he fudged the data, you know? Well, it's actually a little too small. What's happening is you're not seeing enough big variations to have as many small p-values as you should. Okay, so what classifier do we use? Well, we happen to use AdaBoost. We could as well use something else. I am not interested in, let me put it this way, if the success or failure of something I design comes down to which classifier I chose from the family of good machine learning classifiers, then that disappoints me a lot. My goal is to build a system that's to some extent invariant to the choice, you know, that everything that makes it work is in the architecture, is in the design, not in the particular learning algorithm you use for the components. So we use AdaBoost, but somebody else did something very, very similar, Francois told me, using SVMs, and it was about identical performance. So, okay, I'm going to skip this. I said I was going to skip the ear thing. I didn't. This one I'm really skipping with a one-sentence summary. We just did some experiments to get the obvious conclusions. We just wanted to make sure. So sure enough, if you try to just divide the pose space into tiny little cells and visit all of them, you know what I mean? And it's you're killed in a high-dimensional pose space. It's obvious. By the way, that's why cascades will never generalize. Okay, that's I know that's an inflammatory statement. Cascades will never generalize. Why will cascades never generalize? Because how does a cascade work? You fix a cell of poses. It might just be a small cell of positions and scales. And you go everywhere, and you run the cascade. You go to all positions, or all little cells of positions, all little ranges of scales, and you run it again. So you're going to be killed on one end or the other. If the pose cell you fix, the generic reference pose cell, is large, you will have low discrimination. You'll always have false positives. But it'll be computationally efficient because you have a smaller partition of the pose space. If the pose cell is fine, then you will have a computational nightmare because you will be dividing a gigantic pose space into, you know, just billions and trillions of little pieces and running the cascade at each one. It might be actually very powerful, but it'll be very, very slow. So I don't see how to solve the problem. I don't see how to extend cascades to a complex pose space without going to a hierarchy rather than a chain. Okay, so I talked about this already. This is the coarse-defined processing. So now we have a hierarchy. It has two levels. And the whole talk, really, the whole thing is right here. You divide up your image into little, actually, they're like 10 by 10 windows. You build a cat detector keyed only to the center of the head. So it's just like you built a face detector or something. You see what I mean? You just bring all the training data. I mean, well, it's the same to shift the features. It's only translation, so it's equivalent to do the whole image transform or the pose index features. So you build your favorite cat detection that's supposed to detect a cat head. You get all the locations where you found a positive response. I've done the first level. I've done all. The root classifier was null, let's say. I just assume it's one. Now I did all the second level ones. I found these three positions. These are correct. This is a false alarm. Now I go and I look around the head, and I have the empirical joint distribution of the features of the poses. I can write that down. I know the conditional distribution of the body position given the head from my training set. So I know where to look. I know what part of the space to chunk up as a possible location for the belly. I go to all of those positions, and I run the classifier I have built. I built it from all the training data because of the pose index, because of the stationary features. I run that classifier, and ideally, I'd be left with these two detections. So let me contrast. Here's my definition of a true detection and a false positive. The green one is a true detection because the detected head position is close enough to the true, and the detected belly is close enough, and obviously that's a user input, blah, 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 right? I mean, I think we picked 25 pixels relative to a head of 50 pixels. All of these are mistakes. This is a mistake on both ends. This has got the head right, but the belly wrong. This has the belly right, but the head wrong. That's obvious, right? So that's how I classify detections as true detections or false positives. OK, I'm going to show you this as an ROC curve rather than as numbers. So there's two things I want to contrast, two ways I could skin this cat. One is I could build a head detector, just like we do and everybody else would do, and separately build a belly detector by the same exact mechanism where I just align to the belly. So the head detector doesn't know about bellies, and the belly detector doesn't know about heads. Everywhere I get a detection for the head detector, I go into a region around it and run the belly detector. That's what I mean by H/B. They're separated. And I get this ROC curve. Now, this isn't that bad. We have thousands and thousands of pictures of cats. I'm going to show you them in a moment. It's hard. And for example, at 50% detection rate, you're getting, I don't know, what is that point? It's on a log scale. You know, whatever, 5 false positives per 640 by 480. That's not that bad. I mean, it's pretty good. And the same technology, you know, is getting 1 on the heads, on the faces, false positive. So it's pretty good. But if you take into account where the head is when you look for the belly, which is effect, which is what the stationary features are allowing you to do without losing data, then you do an order of magnitude better. And those are the kinds of improvements I like to see. You know, I mean, at 50% detection rate, you're whatever that point is, rather than over here. It's a roughly an order of magnitude better performance by using the stationary features than by building it in a kind of standard way. OK, so first, random. This is a random sample from the thousands of images of the results of the detection algorithm. We have background images, too, just gazillions of background images. And I'll just let you look at it a little bit. You'll get a sense of how well the thing performs. It's a random sample. You know, there's a lot of mistakes. I mean, that's a mistake. That's correct. They're all, I'm sorry, here, you would have thought, expected to see them in green and red or something. No, they're all in this red color, but some of them are mistakes. So one of these is correct, I guess. One of them is a mistake. That's correct. Well, you get the idea. I don't remember whether this is a mistake or not. I don't know if this point is close enough to the belly center or not. And it doesn't just explode on texture. I mean, usually there's nothing. So this is a random sample, and here's another random sample. More scenes picked at random. Just asked Francois to make it a little bigger so he could see it a little better. You know, these cats, OK, these are people taking pictures of their cats, you know, in their houses. So they're cute, you know, so the cat's in the sink, and the cat's under a hat, you know, and the, you know, all kinds of weird stuff, you know. The cat's in the sink, so this our classifier just explodes here. And then here are some results, selected false alarms. Wanted to show you the thing kind of blowing up. So for some reason, it just goes nuts on this cat. I don't know why. And you, I guess you also can get a sense of the diversity of the pose.
How many matches did you use to train?
About 1,700. I think it was like 1,700 to train and testing. I think I wrote it earlier, but it was roughly 3/4 of the 2,300 to train and 1/4 to test. I don't have time to go into this, but these are some of the stationary features. And each one actually has an interpretation, comparing two windows. And you have to really think through. And you know, it drove us nuts at first. And then we would look at them and say, oh, I see what that feature is doing. These are the ones selected by the Ada Boost. I'm showing you 6 features from the base feature pool, you know, that were selected by the Ada Boost. So I want to finish on time, so I'm not going to linger on that. So we think of this as a folded hierarchy, like a fan. So you have this hierarchy. Think of folding it for training so that you only have to train 1 classifier per level, and then opening it for testing. So that's what we refer to as a folded hierarchy. And it's very efficient for learning and for scene processing. But there's some problems. So, you know, now we're 2008, and I told you my view of the situation in 2000. So I would say this performance is achieved at the expense of 2 things. One, cuts against the grain of modern work in computer vision because we need richly annotated data. And many people are moving these days toward, you know, semi-supervised learning and so forth. What we're trying to do right now is see how few cats we can train on, not how many. I'm not interested in going from 2,000 to 20,000 to 112. I'm far more interested in going from 2,000 to 200. So I would be very happy if we could get the same performance, we haven't tried it yet, with 200 cats. So another alternative to all the semi-supervised stuff is a small number of richly annotated examples. I think that's an alternative that's interesting and worth exploring. And the other thing, and this is, you know, you asked it and everybody asks it, is designing the stationary features. How do you do that? How do you do that automatically? That's a big question. We know they exist. We've done so. We've defined them manually. You know what I mean? And we know they're stationary. They satisfy statistical hypothesis tests. So we know they exist. But how would you do it automatically? If you can do it automatically, then you can beat this data fragmentation thing. And this is the acknowledgement. That's the website, Rate My Kitten. That's where we got these 112,000 pictures of cats. Like I said, we have 110,000 we've never looked at. And that's it.
We have 3 minutes for questions.
You mentioned your students actually computed the histograms of thousands of features. So are those features pre-selected by a human? It just sounds...
Yeah, we do. We wanted to just... No, it's a very artificial thing. You have the cat ears, and it was just based on reflection. So once you define a feature in one coordinate frame, you just know what it should be in the other. You see what I mean? Just because it's only reflection. The two ears are more or less going in the two directions. It was an ideal case. We just thought to ourselves, we better get a uniform distribution of p-values here. Because if we don't get a uniform distribution of p-values here, it's never going to happen in something more complex.
So how many Bayes features do you use?
40, well, we tried. In that histogram you saw was 44,000. Each one corresponds to a window and an edge. Type. 44,000.
Yeah. At the end of the talk, you point out a very interesting problem, which is, can we get the same results but with far less training samples,
yeah,
training data? But what is your view if we want to really get human performance? What do we need to do?
Well, what do you mean by human? Okay, so when Francois and I did this work in the 90s, and we wrote it up, and we sent it to a journal. One of the criticisms, we found it amazing. We trained on the ORL database. We had 40 people, 400 images. That was our training set. Jan LeCun and others were training with 60,000, 80,000 pictures of faces. We were training with 400 pictures, 40 people, 40 people. Actually, we were training on 30 people, 300 pictures, because there's 10 views of each person. And I thought, that was an advantage. In my naivete, I thought the fact that we were getting very good results, at some point Jan and I had exactly the same rock curves, but we were training with 100 times fewer examples. I thought, and one of the reviewers said, you know, well, if you're so stupid as to train with only 400 pictures, you know, it's your fault. What happens if you train with, you know, 50,000, 100,000? So I would answer your question this way. If we want to reach human performance, the sample size should go to 1, not infinity. Because for those who've had children know, and everybody knows, that when you're teaching your child how to recognize handwritten digits, and you start showing them some 3s, it's unbelievable. I mean, you show them a 3, and then you show them another 3, and you show them 3s, and then yeah, I got the idea already, Dad, you know. I mean, then you show them one that's nothing to do with anyone they've ever seen, and they nail it. And they have the concept. They don't need 100,000 examples of a handwritten three to get the idea of a three. Really, they need order 10. So you said if you want to get to human performance by what measure? Human performance by ROC curve or human performance by the efficiency of learning? I would argue if you want to reach human performance by the efficiency of learning, we should all be cutting our training sets by a factor of 100.
But should we focus learning better feature, better classifier, better architecture?
Well, I'm on the architectures. I believe that the machine learning tools, AdaBoost and all, are beautiful. They're beautiful. But they have to be integrated into an organized framework. I don't think it's going to solve the image interpretation problem by itself. I think they're tools to be integrated into a larger framework, and it's that framework that's missing. I mean, how do you, you know, we recognize 30,000 object categories in about 150 milliseconds. I mean, I just don't see how anything we have around is going to generalize to come anywhere near human performance, you know. Our face detection works from the front of the face. Human, we get on a bus at night and we recognize somebody from the back of their head. I mean, there's a long way to go. Something's missing.
I think it's a very interesting talk. I was wondering if you tried this algorithm on a data set with both dogs and cats.
I know, it's the right question, and here's what I suspect would happen. If we tried this on a picture, on pictures of, you know, squirrels and mice, I think we'd find cats all over the place. That's what I guess. I heard there was a cute story at Microsoft Asia. Somebody told me this story. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not. That somebody there sent a team off to see if they could detect cats and dogs. Is there somebody in there named Harry Shum or something like that? And somebody came back with the answer. This is what I heard. I don't know if it's true. Cats maybe, dogs no. So we thought about dogs as another category. It doesn't answer your question about a cat versus a squirrel versus whatever. But I think dogs are much, much harder than cats. They're not as deformable. But think about how many different kinds of dogs there are. And I noticed that on some of these data sets, like isn't there one that's the C? No, it's not C. I'm not CMU. Caltech, this and that. Yeah, I just noticed that people flounder on some of the on the dog database, for example, part of it, the dog subset. I think that's really hard dogs.
Architecture is to exactly define what's the pulse space. And the pulse space is going to be different for different object
exactly.
Categories. So do you have any idea how to automatically, again, learn this pulse space?
No, I don't. Don't know.
Many years of research. Anybody else has some questions? Not, I encourage you, everybody, to join the post-seminar reception and actually ask Professor Dimon any questions you have or some interesting ideas he has about how to avoid some conference papers.
Should make an ad. Go to my website and read 10 reasons why conference papers should be abolished.
So, you know. So, let's thank the speaker again.